So last week we got to revisit A Raisin in the Sun. We also talked about these two biological imperatives. The first being the biological imperative for freedom. And Gil Fronsdale, just to remind you of what he said about this imperative, he said that somehow the depth, the core of what this Dhamma practice is about, it's not up to you. And I still love that he says that, because he's pointing to this renunciation of control, that this path, just by virtue of practicing, we're relinquishing, we're letting go of control, we're letting go into trusting the Dhamma. Right? Says that somehow the depth, the core of what this Dhamma practice is about, it's not up to you. Something's going to be working through you. And it's nothing mystical. It's not like coming from outside. It's a potential, a possibility that lives in your own heart. The biological imperative for freedom. And then we talked about the biological imperative to avoid pain. And that this imperative or this impulse to avoid pain and the reactivity that comes out of it is a real innocent movement of the heart. That we're just wanting to be well. We're wanting to be safe. We're wanting our loved ones to be safe. And in my opinion, these two imperatives don't need to be in opposition to each other. That we can integrate them through befriending our reactivity with patience, with self-compassion, and with empathy that's grounded in using our imagination in moral and ethical ways. So that's what we explored and played with last week. And I'm wanting to continue looking at ways of integrating these two imperatives, these two biological imperatives, but through the practice of renunciation. We so love the Brahmaviharas. But the practice of renunciation can feel really challenging. So just notice what arises for you when you hear the word renunciation or the phrase to renounce. Just take a moment to notice what thoughts, images, emotions, sensations of the body, what comes. Again, we're just tapping into our, just touching into our current relationship with renunciation. And we can meet what arises with curiosity, this qualities of sati, open, receptive, attentive, knowing. So in a conversation with the Buddha, or the Buddha in conversation with Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and his beloved attendant for 25 years or so, In this conversation, the Buddha talks about his own associations with renunciation before he had awakened. And this is what he says. He says, even I myself, and this emphasis on even I myself, he's saying to Ananda, even me, Ananda, like, you know me, Ananda, you know how much I love seclusion, you know how much I love renunciation, but even I myself, before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, thought, renunciation is good, seclusion is good, but my heart didn't leap up at renunciation, didn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm. So if you hear the word renunciation or the phrase to renounce and your heart does not leap up, you cringe, the heart kind of wilts, you're not alone. Even the Buddha before his awakening, like us before our awakening. And when you think of the Buddha's heart not leaping up at seclusion and renunciation, you get the sense that he had ideas that weren't quite in line with what renunciation is. I feel like we all have misconceptions about renunciation. When I first heard this phrase, renunciation, I thought that to renounce things and to renounce ways of being, to commit to a life of letting go, meant that I won't ever enjoy anything beautiful. That somehow I was dedicating my life to a life of deprivation. And I think we have this fear that renunciation is going to desensitize us to that which is beautiful, that which is good, that which is just. And I think one of the kind of most heartbreaking misconceptions about renunciation is that it means we reject the world, that we reject our place in the world and what it is that we have to offer. That somehow we think we're rejecting our relationships and all that we care for and all that matters to us. Oh, in other words, at least this was the case for me, it was as if renunciation, I was being banished to this bleak wasteland, devoid of any spontaneity, creativity, devoid of any wholesome desire. I want to be straight up with you. I would not be on this path if the promise was bleakness. So this is a renunciate path. That does not lead to bleakness, to letting go of the world, renouncing the world. It actually leads to varying degrees of freedom and to full awakening, to nibbana. I have a friend who reminds me, and it's meant so much to me, I just carry it with me wherever I go, that the conditions for awakening are here in our life. And to believe that it's possible to awaken with the conditions that we have. Can you all hear the rain out there? It is storming. It is windy. I'm going to send it over to you guys. California needs it, yeah? And this path, nibbana, is called the highest happiness, profound peace, unshakable deliverance from a heart and mind. Just a profound, how to say it, unshakable deliverance from greed, aversion, and delusion. You can think of renunciation as letting go of craving, especially craving of sense pleasure. The suttas talk about renunciation as a blessing, that we can actually delight in renunciation. The suttas talk of joy based in renunciation, equanimity based in renunciation, that there's even a bliss of renunciation, and that renunciation is peaceful. And you start to feel this when you have a regular meditation practice or you're in a long retreat. You let go of the complications of your thoughts, chasing after pleasant sensory experience, getting caught up in thoughts of the past and remembering, future tripping, like thinking about the present moment, commenting on the present moment, and just resting in the very simple experience of sensations of the body, breath, sounds, awareness of space. That when we rest in these simple experiences, that somehow it calls forth the simplicity and peace of our own heart and mind. And the heart and mind starts to rest content within itself. I like to think of renunciation as letting go of that which we no longer need. Yeah, letting go of what doesn't actually serve and support our health and well-being, our freedom. Not only for ourselves, but the communities that we're a part of, families that we're a part of, the people that we love. That we can let go of habits that that letting go ends up being a support for the network and connections that we're a part of. This is from the Dhammapada. If by giving up a lesser happiness, one could experience a greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. And I'm sure most of you know that Venerable Inalio characterizes this path, this practice, as a training in the progressive refinement of joy. This path is not bleak. Renunciation is not bleak. It's a progressive refinement of joy. And I love that he uses this word progressive because it connotes it's gradual. We don't mature into renunciation all at once. We just let go a little at a time. In fact, the suttas talk about, and you can actually hear this as an instruction. Dependent on this, abandon that. Let's see. No, that won't. Dependent on this, so this is a bracelet that I received from Ayasanthachitta from Alokabahara. And it's a bracelet of wooden skulls. And I just use it as a reminder that my body, this body, is mortal and will die. And sometimes death really touches me and I can bring it into my life. And sometimes it just feels pretty far off, but I still persist in the practice of contemplating my own mortality. So dependent on this contemplation of, say, death, abandon this bone. And you think I'm playing, but I'm not. Just to be clear, it's on airplane mode and I'm using it as a timepiece. But these bones, they're so constantly checking. And they say that when we get a new email, there's like a little hit of pleasure in the mind. And that's why we constantly keep checking to get that little hit. It can be so addictive, right? But if we really contemplated our death, really allowed it to touch the heart, incorporated into our lives, and it became real for us, would I spend as much time on this phone, right? Dependent on this, abandon that. The Buddha was so compassionate. He recognized that the human heart needs a refuge. Even if the refuge is a temporary one, even if it's not the final ultimate refuge of complete freedom of Nibbana. And I feel like the subtext of this instruction, dependent on this, abandon that, actually, with the subtext of any instruction from the Buddha, I feel like he's talking to me, that he's talking directly to me, that he's encouraging me, that he's cheering me on. And I feel like the subtext of this, dependent on this, abandon that, I feel like he's saying, go ahead. I know you need to hold on to this. Go ahead and hold on. While you're holding on, look for another way of being. Look for another way of living in the world that supports true refuge, that supports true health, that supports true freedom. Like, okay, you found another way. You found another way to relate to the fluidity of life, its imperfection, its lack of control. And you don't quite trust it yet. All right, that's fine. Just keep holding on. But while you're holding on to this, start to put your weight into this new way of being. It's trustworthy. It will hold you. It will see you through. And just start to give it your full weight. The heart can give itself over to this. It's actually trustworthy. And I feel like he's saying now, very slowly, in your own time, at your own pace, let that old way of being go. Dependent on this, abandon that. It's a gradual process that we come to through allowing ourselves to find a new way of being and slowly discovering its trustworthiness at our own pace, at our own time, so that we can let go of the lesser happiness for a brighter, fuller, more satisfying contentment. Dependent on this, abandon that. So you can look at renunciation as a letting go of our drive, our compulsion, our addiction to craving itself. And yes, we let go of the objects of craving, but we're also seeing through craving, we're seeing it and we're understanding it. And through that process, we actually let go of the activity of craving itself. And that said, we do this, we let go of craving through working with the objects of craving. We crave ways of being, moods, thoughts, emotions, states. We crave being itself. We crave sense objects and sights, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations of the body. Sense pleasures do offer a temporary pleasure, but not the peace that the heart really longs for. Some of the beautiful aspirations that you named last week. This is from Suzuki Roshi. Renunciation is not giving up the things of the world, but accepting that things go away. Renunciation is not giving up things of this world, but accepting that they go away. So we know pleasure that's had through the sense gates. We know it viscerally. The pleasure of a cup of coffee in the morning, a cup of tea and its warmth and how it pervades into the hands. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of pleasure. The trouble starts when the mind starts casting about looking for relief from dukkha through pleasant sensory experience. So instead of having an honest encounter with dukkha so that it can be understood and that craving can actually be abandoned, we're in the habit of taking the edge off of dukkha through seeking pleasant sense experience. And this habit keeps us beholden to the precarious nature of sense objects. Because sense objects, as Suzuki Roshi was saying, what he was pointing to, they're fluid, they're in flux, they're dynamic, they're inconstant, they're changing. They don't offer lasting pleasure. They're time bound. Their pleasure is time bound. Short lived, they're dukkha. In fact, when sense desire starts to fade within the heart and mind, the Buddha likens it to being released from a debt. And just play with that for a moment. And you just start to feel into and enter into that simile. Comparing being beholden to sense objects to being in financial debt. Just hold that in your heart and mind for a moment. It can be really delightful to just drop in a simile into the body, into the mind, and just allow it to just work on the psyche, work on the body. When craving starts to abate, it's compared to being released from debt, financial debt. Never enough. Happiness is always out there. So we buy and buy and spend, but what we purchase doesn't offer the, doesn't quite satisfy. And there's this inner lack, there's this craving. So we buy and we buy and we spend, and the debt just gets, it increases, the craving increases, and it leads to this never-ending cycle of having to borrow from here and there just to get this fleeting hit of pleasure, fleeting hit of pleasant. what keeps us bound in the cycle of samsara. So this word craving is synonymous with wanting, greed. And it's so interesting with craving, because we're not, if you check it out, we're not even actually wanting the object itself. We're actually craving our ideas about the object, our ideas about the experience, what it will give us, the promise of the experience. We get enchanted with what Andrea Fella calls craving's story. And the story and the craving, in a way, uses us. It wields us. The craving uses our words and our actions to obtain its object. It uses us as a tool to gratify itself. It's as if craving fills the body. And you feel that sometimes. It's like, I was just taken over and I said that thing or I did that thing. We were in our rational mind, weren't taken over by craving. We wouldn't have behaved in the way that we did. It uses us as a tool. If we just get this, move this way, say that, take this action, then fill in the blank of craving story. So this word craving is synonymous with wanting and greed. It's also a shorthand for the interplay between greed, aversion, and delusion. We have this mistaken belief, and this is the delusion, that happiness will persist through having as many pleasant experiences as possible, keeping the negative ones at bay. The pleasant experiences, the greed, keeping the negative, unpleasant, unfavorable away from us. That's the aversion. And out of this deluded belief, we look for happiness outside ourselves. Our happiness is contingent on some sense pleasure. And you see this so clearly with the play of pleasant and unpleasant vedana, this push-pull into wanting and not wanting. The Buddha's teaching on the second arrow just so clearly names this dynamic and the human condition. His similes are so striking. Shot by an arrow, shot by a second arrow. We experience pain, and pain of dukkha, and we look for relief from it through sense pleasure. And in the process, we end up creating this underlying tendency, this underlying habit of running from dukkha into the false refuge of sense pleasure. And it's really important to name here that the use of sense pleasure in a wise way may be a really important part of our practice. Perhaps we've experienced things that have resulted in us feeling unsafe in our bodies. So it's important to claim a sense of safety in the body, in the heart, mind, in the nervous system. And I actually had this happen to me recently. I was in a 4-week retreat. It was about 2 weeks in. I was working with mindfulness of breathing. My heart mind was pretty open. And the body was quite soft and porous. I went out for a walk. And on this walk, there was someone who was quite ill. They weren't balanced. And they started to verbally harass me. I wasn't in any danger. I wasn't going to be harmed in any way. I quickly saw like, oh, this is more bark than bite. But the body thought I was in danger. So to actually recover some sense of safety, it was really helpful to take in simple sense pleasures just to soothe and calm my own nervous system, to start to restore a sense of safety in my body. And to me, that's a skillful use of sense pleasure. And there are times when the mind is actually imbalanced and there's some measure of safety in the heart mind. And in those instances, we actually have an opportunity to intervene on this pattern of looking for relief from dukkha through casting about for pleasant sensory experience. Some of you may be familiar with Jaya Rudgard. She's a practitioner and a teacher. She lives in England. She teaches here in the States and was a part of the last iteration of the IMS Spirit Rock teacher training. And she was a monastic in the Thai forest tradition for about 8 years. So she knows a lot about renunciation. And in all her years of practice in robes, she actually suggests a gentle approach to renunciation, a gentle approach to letting go of craving. And this is what she has to say. She said, there may be certain areas of entanglement for you that you'd like to explore, but I really don't recommend doing this in times or when there isn't really some basic sense of contentment and well-being. She goes on to say, I heard that Ajahn Suchito once described, if we demand renunciation of ourselves or of our students when they're not in a place of well-being, it's kind of like stealing from a beggar. If we demand renunciation of ourselves or of our students when they're not in a place of well-being, it's kind of like stealing from a beggar. Now, in this world, with all of its joy and sorrow, gain and loss, global pandemic, political dysfunction, a heart needs a resting place. And we usually take refuge in craving. And until we found wholesome ways to actually meet the legitimate needs at the center of our craving, to challenge that craving is a kind of theft. So when we're in a place of well-being, we can do what Jaya calls playing with the edges of our habits, playing with the edges of our craving. And she talks about it as finding a practice of simplification that goes against the current of craving. And we start with a really small simplification practice, like the habits around our phone. And we start small because we don't want to tax the heart too much. Our cravings actually serve a purpose. They help us navigate the intensity of living in a dukkha realm. Just this pandemic and the emotional and economic fallout due to this, to Corona, that's a lot to navigate. And our cravings, they serve a purpose. They help us navigate the challenges of dukkha. I was so struck by what Joseph Goldstein said about this. He said, it's said that the reason enlightenment happens in stages is because we don't have the capacity all at once to open to the first truth of dukkha, of suffering, unreliable nature of things. It's said that the reason enlightenment happens in stages is because we don't have the capacity to open to all at once, open to the first noble truth of dukkha, that the suffering, unreliable nature of things. Dukkha is vast. It is deep. If you believe in the multiple lifetime model, it takes multiple lifetimes to actually digest it and to come into some balance and equipoise so that we're not knocked over by it. So we open up to the truth of dukkha and the truth of craving by playing with renunciation a little at a time. And as our practice matures, we actually start to experience the heart alternating and starting to do this figure eight between periods of purification. The heart is just unburdening itself of attitudes and ways of being that no longer serve it. And then that's followed by like states of freedom, where the heart feels so light, like your whole being feels so light. The body feels light. When we see into the nature of reality, we encounter, say, impermanence, the changing nature of things. And just seeing this starts to wash away our cravings. It's like the heart mind at a very visceral level, in like in the bones, starts to understand why grasp, why cling, why lament over that which is going to persist as change and then eventually just pass away? Why do that? And the heart mind starts to understand that in the bones, it's not just here, it actually moves down into the heart. There's a move down into the body. There's a huge paradigm shift. And as our cravings are washed away, just by seeing into the impermanent nature of things, our heart mind can start to drop into states of dispassion. And these states of dispassion allow the heart to see our moment-to-moment experience come to an end. You can actually see it cease. And we see it, our experience ceasing, coming to an end from a place of real equipoise, balance. Because there is this dispassion in the heart's, in the heart-mind stream. This is from Venerable Anālya. He says, the more we're able to allow things to end, to be at ease with cessation and recognize peacefulness, the better we will be at letting go, renunciation. Gradually letting go of all of our remaining attachments prepares us for the supreme letting go, the plunge into the deathless, the realization of Nibbana. So let's just sit for a moment. the more we're able to allow things to end, to be at ease with cessation and recognize peacefulness, the better we will be at letting go. Gradually letting go of all remaining attachments prepares us for the supreme letting go, the plunge into the deathless, the realization of Nibbana. Thank you so much. So good to be with you. So good to practice with you. Thank you for your attention. As Mary Kelly was saying, just start to turn the heart toward metta. Yeah, when we let go of craving, what can shine through the heart is beautiful qualities, a friendliness, a warmth. So just letting that shine through.